This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You have reached the edge of the world. Today on Dreamland, we have a really extraordinary guest. Gary Lachman is with us. Not many members of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame are recognized authority on the Western inner tradition, the occult, and the world of the mystical. But Gary is. He has gone from being one of the founders of Blondie as Gary Valentine, and through an incredible life. And we're going to explore that with Gary today. He started as a rock and roller, then became a writer on consciousness in the Western tradition, and has had a tremendous journey. He knew people that I also knew, Allen Ginsberg, William Burroughs. He's been involved with the Gurdjieff Foundation, as I have indeed also. He is the author also of The Return of Holy Russia, Maurice Nicole, Forgotten Teacher of the Fourth Way, and Dark Star Rising. I am a student of Maurice Nicole's work. I've read it many times and discussed it deeply. It's terribly important work. Gary, welcome to Dreamland. I'm so proud to have you on the show.
Well, thank you so much. I'm absolutely delighted to be here.
Touched by the presence. It's really an incredible life journey. But let's start with the 70s and CBGBs and Blondie and that world. I lived about three blocks from CBGBs in those days. I don't recall ever seeing you there, but I may have. I don't know that we saw Blondie, but we went a lot. Ann and I did, my wife. So,
well, I lived at 266 Bowery, which was the south side of Houston Street, which was a bit further down. William Burroughs had his bunker. That whole area, actually, recently I did a map. There's a company called Herb Lester here in the UK, and I've done a series of sort of cultural maps for them, and I did one about the New York underground scene. So all these places, I've mapped them out where they are. And this all happens, well, a couple things are above 14th Street, but it relatively is between 14th Street and Houston Street. But no, I lived there in 1975. This became known as the Blondie Loft. And it was just, just the other side of Houston from CBGB, the other side of the street, but right, the other side of Houston. And
did you ever spend any time at Max's?
Oh yeah, yeah. No, no. We played there. There was the original Max. There was the original Max's in the heyday, Mickey Ruskin when he had it, and then he let it go, and then he got a couple of ventures downtown. There was the Ocean Club was one thing, and there was a couple other things. But then somebody else took over Max's, not that long after CBGB's had really got going. There was a lot of press about it. And so Blondie, we played in both places. And when I had my own band later on, The No, we played in Max's quite a bit, not so much CBGB's, but there. But I was living there. I was actually in that milieu, and I was living in this dilapidated loft space with Debbie Harry and Chris Stein, that I first came across the sort of thing that I've subsequently made a life work out of reading. This was his introduction to Aleister Crowley. There was this wild, flamboyant, gay biker artist who had the lease, insofar as there was such a thing, on this building, and who rented us our floor. And he used to do these impromptu tarot readings with Crowley's Thoth tarot deck and things like that. And then the other book, the book that literally changed my life, was this book just called The Occult by Colin Wilson. And it was such a well-written, compelling narrative, as the best blurbs say, about this world that I didn't know anything about, that I just became completely, completely fascinated with it.
But you were attracted to it, and that's interesting, because most people in that community weren't I mean, they did, some did, and I've talked to some of them, but who in the community drew you toward this material or
Well,
anybody?
there was one single person, was this fellow, his name was Benton Quinn. He passed away some years ago. But he had the lease on this building, and there were three
Right.
floors. And so funnily enough, the last time I was in New York, pre-COVID in 2019, I went to my old neighborhood, and everywhere else is completely unrecognizable. My joke is, forget the rents, you can't afford the cappuccinos. It's just like, so skyrocketed. But this place where we lived, it looked exactly the same, and I was so gratified to see it had graffiti on the door, and the restaurant supply shop was still there, and there was a liquor
Oh, I
store
know the
still.
building then. I know exactly
Yeah,
where it's from.
no. Literally, if you're on Bowery, the other side of the street from CBGB's, and from
Right.
Bleecker on, you just walk south, you'll pass it. I mean,
You put
it's
past there because that, yeah, that restaurant supply place is
266
still there.
Bowery. So if you're down there, but any case, he was the person, and he was the gateway keeper for me, this fellow. And he also, for many other reasons as well, he introduced me to Persky, for whom I wrote a song called "I'm Always Touched by Your Presence, Dear," which is about these psychic experiences we had together, and that's the title of the book is an allusion to that. But the thing was, it was the previous generation, it was the '60s generation that had magic and the occult kind of in the foreground, and the way I subsequently described it, there was like the debris from that generation still kind of hanging on in the mid '70s in people's apartments and things and bookshelves and things like that. So High Priest by Leary or Castaneda's books and that sort of stuff. That's how I came across Wilson's Occult. I mean, I just found it on somebody's bookshelf. It was Tommy Ramone's bookshelf, the original drummer from the Ramones, who's another who has passed away.
Yeah. Was
So so
Tommy
that
into
was,
this?
I mean, I just think it was something that was just there. People just had these books and they read this stuff. I mean, when I
Right,
live with
that.
Chris and Debbie, they had a kitschy kind of fun poppy camp interest in voodoo and stuff. So it was this kind of atmosphere. It was this sort of bric-a-brac in a way
And
around.
anyone who goes from there to Aleister Crowley and Maurice Nicole and G.I. Gurdjieff is no dilettante. I mean, that's a serious journey, man.
Well, I mean, that got me interested. I just that was I mean, I had read, I mean, the first serious stuff I read was like 1970, a hippie girl I had a crush on gave me a copy of Hesse's Siddhartha. So that was like the first serious literature. Before that, I was a great reader of weird pulp fiction like H.P. Lovecraft and that kind of thing. And comic books were the really thing that got me going in the first place. I mean,
You know, that's
the comic books from
interesting.
this. Sorry, go.
No, I'm just saying that trajectory is very familiar to me. As I was into EC Comics when I was young, and my father, I told Stephen King the story of my father throwing him out the window. And then I see Creepshow, and it starts with this father throwing guys EC Comics out the window. And I thought, I wonder
Right,
must have made an impression on him.
yeah.
Anyway, I haven't seen him, but I don't know him. I want to give that impression. I don't know Stephen King at all, but I met him once and at a party, and I told the story to about 20 people at the party. So, anyway, the trajectory from comics to the kind of the Lovecraft world, and I was so fascinated with that. I knew a guy named Robert Bloch, who wrote Psycho and quite a
Well, of
famous author, and we were friends.
course.
And we decided at one point that, there'd never been a Lovecraft novel, and that we would have a bet that one of us could write an entire novel in the Lovecraft world. And I did it, actually. I did. It's called The Forbidden Zone. And it on the cover is a big blurb from Bob because we said so it was I was really into that stuff. And then
No, I mean, well, he's fantastic. I mean, he's actually a character in one of Lovecraft's last stories, The Haunter of the Dark. As I said, I did this map about the New York scene. I also did one about Lovecraft. His places
oh.
in Providence, but also where he lived in New York and in Brooklyn, and you know, the horror at Red Hook and all of that, which is the horror of Clinton Street, which is where he lived in Brooklyn. So, but no, I mean, I got so into, I mean, the gateway for me was actually the Robert E. Howard Conan stories, and that's because I was fascinated. I love the Frank Frazetta covers of the Lancer paperbacks. And if you know, again, this is the Silver Age, this is the 1960s. So I'm from that time. And they're these fantastic, you know, sensual, muscular, and these incredibly buxom women that are always there with the monsters. And it's like, you know, so I'm adolescent. And so I got into the Howard stuff. And then it was like Weird Tales, so the trajectory, but then Clark Ashton Smith, who was much more lapidary. Through him, because he talked about the French symbolists and Baudelaire and Gautier and things like that. So there was this whole kind of everything just opened up. So that was the early, like, comic books, pulp literature, what was called adult fantasy. There was a writer and editor named Lynn Carter back then, who for Ballantine paperbacks, he edited the series in the late 60s and early 70s, like E.R.R. Edison. This was the aftermath of the Tolkien explosion, you know, when Tolkien became
Yes.
very popular on the campus, and suddenly this kind of fantasy was money making and all that.
Right, and it came out of, and those balance, a lot of those Ballantine paperbacks were pretty wonderful, I
Oh,
thought.
yeah.
That was a wonderful series. Now, you mentioned, we talked about Lovecraft. You mentioned also the influence of Hesse and Siddhartha, which of course is a book that opened spirituality to a lot of people. A couple of years ago, I went to India, and one of the places, of course, I really wanted to go was to sit under the Bodhi tree, even though it's not the original Bodhi tree, it's a cutting from it now, but never the original, having being in Sri Lanka. It was an awesome experience for me, and reading Siddhartha was what it drew me. It's one of the things that drew me ultimately toward the Gurdjieff work. And I wonder about if you could tell us about your impressions of Siddhartha.
Well, I mean, this was 1970. I was on my way to being 15. It was during this time where Hesse was having this fantastic posthumous, you know, bestsellerdom.
Right.
All of his books. And I mean, one of the funny things, and I write about this in Touched by Your Presence, but also in actually my first book was called Turn Off Your Mind, and it was about the 1960s. The occult revival of the 1960s, part of which was I dealt with the Hesse revival. And I mean, even though he was picked up by the Beats and, you know, kind of the counterculture in Germany, he was like a recognized, you know, author. So he wasn't quite the rebel, even though he wrote about that sort of thing. So it was an odd kind of strange third life for him here. But I was completely taken up with them. Once I read Siddhartha, it was like I wanted to read all of them and I wanted to learn German. And then there was all these other strange people whose names I was, you know, mispronouncing, Goethe and Nitzka. And it's
Goethe.
like, you know, and it's
That's not
like,
too far from
I'm thinking,
Goethe.
well, who are these guys? You know, and I'm trying to like, so, and I'm tracking them down and all that. And one of the remarkable things for me, and I have to say, I'm so grateful this happened, was I tell the story of in my last year in high school. I had this young progressive English teacher. I got kicked out of the other class I was in, and I later was put into his class. And he somehow saw my, you know, who I was and thought I was reading everything, all this other stuff. And he started teaching me something on the side. He started handing me books to read on the side. He taught the rest of the class whatever the regular curriculum was. And he was handing me Sartre and Nietzsche and stuff like that. So it was just this was incredible. I don't know if that happens anymore these days. It's like kind of like Dead Poets Society or something like that, but it was absolutely
Well, it
fantastic.
does. It does in this country. It does in the private schools, not so much in the public schools, because they have very strict rules regarding curriculum. And that's my oldest grandchild dropped out of public school and school altogether for that reason, and just became his own teacher, and it has a fabulous education as a result of it. He's just graduated from school. He has He's got an official diploma from
Sure. No,
the
of course,
school,
yeah.
but
Sure.
he basically created his own curriculum. And
Well, I mean, I did something similar in my teenage years because I spent a lot of time at the library, and
yeah,
I just
that's
like
exactly
I
what
just
he
like
did.
haunted the what they call the stacks, and it's just whatever it was I was interested in. I just would get a, I was never so happy as when I had like a pile of books in front of me on one of these decks back in the, the cobweb corners of the stacks where nobody goes to, and I would just like read all this indiscriminate stuff and all that. But I mean, the thing with
Yeah.
Hesse, the two Hesse novels that really affected me in my teenage years were it was Beneath the Wheel,
I
which
haven't
is
read
this
that.
that that well, this is like it's an earlier one than the ones that were very popular, like Siddhartha and Steppenwolf and Damien and all. Damien was the other big one for me. Beneath the Wheel is one of these Bildungsroman. It's one of these educational novels where there's a character who's crushed by the system and there's another character who's somehow escapes. And so but at the time it was very much about being in school and having to sort of submit to authority and things of that kind of stuff. And but Damien was the one that, I mean, I subsequently understood it's this, it's this kind of journey through the Jungian in path of individuation, really, which in one sense, in a humble way, I'd like to think my memoir, Touched by the Presence, is something like that, because it is kind of like my story of how I became who I am. And that was in the beginning of this Damien, there's a copy I had. It said something like, I only wanted to follow the promptings of my true self. Why was that so difficult? And you would think this would be the easiest thing in the world, but it actually turns out to be the most difficult thing you could possibly try to do.
Yes, to find that, to really find it, because we hide very skillfully from ourselves. Now, let me think of it. Let's go to Crowley and Thelema. And Crowley, for those of you folks who do not know who Aleister Crowley was, he was cons called by the press to be the most evil man in the world. But that's not quite what was going on. You tell us a little bit about Crowley.
Well, it was also the wickedest man in the world.
Wicked, I guess it was wickedest.
That was the phrase. And it's funny that you say that, because this is in the 1920s, so it's literally a century ago. And the other thing they said, the man we like to hang, and these were all what they used to call the red top, sensational rag sheet newspapers, the scandal sheets. But they said he's the man we'd like to hang. And the funny thing is, in London today, there's the National Portrait Gallery. I mean, it's been around forever, but down in Trafalgar Square, it's one of these fantastic, galleries that are open to the public. But this is all figures from the UK, from Great Britain, important people. And Crowley is the man they'd like to hang because he is well hung. There's actually a portrait of him in this National Portrait Gallery, which is the strangest thing, because he was considered,
Yeah.
this, as you say, this evil character, but now he's considered kind of a national treasure. And a friend of mine said, this is how the British deal with these kind of characters. First you sort of vilify them, then you accept them as an eccentric, the British eccentric, and then you become the national treasure. So that's a long parenthetical remark about who Aleister Crowley was. But he's known as sort of the most famous or infamous magician of the 20th century, in sense of not prestidigitation, but actual, magic in the old school
Now,
of magic.
when you say magician, you mean something very different from what probably crosses through most minds, which is somebody who can take pigeons out of a hat or whatever. He did not necessarily take pigeons out of a hat. What do you
No.
mean by magic?
Well, as I was saying, it's not what they used to call prestidigitation, so stuff you do with your fingers. No, he actually wanted to. He did. This is he made it his life mission to sort of revive what he called like the ancient science of magic, which is this ceremonial magic or the means by which one can. Well, I mean, his definition of magic is I forget what it is now. The science and art by which one can make changes in conformity with will. So actually, it was a way in which you can make changes in the world. So this is the old school actual magic kind of stuff. Not oh, we can just not illusion, not we can just explain it. Actual what we would call the paranormal. But Dean Radin, in a book a few years back, he called real magic, where he basically says what science knows about paranormal and parapsychological phenomena tallies up very well with historical accounts of what we consider magic. So telekinesis and synchronicities. I mean, my own definition of magic is that it is induced synchronicity. So if you know Jung's notion of synchronicity, I'm sure you do, is what, meaningful coincidence, but can you make a meaningful coincidence happen? So that would, consciously, purposefully. So that would be, to me, a definition of magic. And Crowley, he was a wild, tearaway, mad, bad, and dangerous to know kind of character, what we would call, transgressive, very transgressive these days, sexually, he was, experiment with drugs. He came from a strange background. He had his parents, were these very, very fundamentalist Christians, known as the Plymouth Brethren. Particular sect, and they were so strict. They thought Christmas was a pagan holiday and should not be observed. But then they were very rich. His father, who
Well,
was
that helps.
well, I'm saying they're very rich. His father had inherited this brewery, and in the late 19th century into the early 20th century, there were these kind of what they call ale houses called Crowley's Ale, where you could get a pint of beer and a sandwich. So they were kind of that they fit this in sort of intermediary realm between fancy restaurants and just, kind of disreputable pubs or something like that. And so his father had inherited this money, and then Crowley inherited that. And he actually came into quite, what considered sort of millions of pounds at the back then. And he blew that very, very quickly.
Yeah, right,
Well,
sure.
I mean, right, because he published these sumptuous, Vanity Press editions of his poetry, and he went, he lived like, big. He lived it big. He sort of traveled around the world. He climbed, and funnily enough, he actually was quite a good mountaineer. I mean, he was eccentric mountaineer, but he actually achieved some, there were some records that he broke and things like that. He was a chess master. I think in my book about him, which is Aleister Crowley, Magic, Rock and Roll, and the Wickedest Man in the World, I say that he would have made a much better scientist because he had that predilection for this kind of acute, exactness that came out in a kind of weird way in him. But he had this kind of acuity, like things had to be exact, but somehow, that all got mixed up with his own psychological kind of slightly sociopathic personality, where he was completely oblivious to other people's, needs and feelings. And this was his whole philosophy of dilemma. I mean, but I got interested in, as I said, when I was living in the Bowery, on the Bowery in this loft with this fellow, I started reading the books. And then I got seriously involved in it a few years later, when I had left New York and I had left Blondie, and I started my own band called The Know, KNOW, and this was because of my interest in Gnosticism, which I was reading about Gnosis and all that sort of thing. And there used to be this wonderful bookshop on Hollywood Boulevard called Gilbert's. I moved to Los Angeles at this time, on Vine, Hollywood and Vine, actually. And people like Kenneth Anger, the Crowleyite film avant-garde filmmaker, and David
Yeah.
Bowie and Jimmy Page were clients. And I'd go there and I would buy books because I was interested in all this stuff, and I just was a voracious reader. But I saw in the old days before the internet, there was an old bulletin board. There was a little notice for a Crowley group, and I thought, well, I've been reading about this stuff for a few years now. Let's see what happens. So I was all of 22 at the time, and I just wrote to them, and not long after, somebody turned up at the door of the house I was living in, and asked me if I was ready to, devote myself to the knowledge and conversation of my holy guardian angel. I had
Oh,
to think
wow.
about it for how to think about it. It was sort of like a Jehovah's Witness asking if you wanted to join, so I had to think about it for a minute.
A Jehovah's Witness of the occult.
And I said, okay. I said, okay, right. So I did that. And then for, I don't know, about a year or so, I got involved. But it all kind of went sour. Because even though I've met many people that are serious Thelemites, that are serious, followers of Crowley's religion. And they actually do what they wilt. Many interpret that as do what you like, which sadly Crowley himself did in many ways. He was not a good person to know, never lent him money, things of that sort. And the people I got involved with, one person in particular was actually rather like this, and it all kind of went bad and all that. But I outgrew it fairly quickly because, I mean, he's interesting. He's a wonderful raconteur. I mean, his confessions are it's just a great read because he's very good writing about himself. But after a while, it becomes claustrophobic. It was kind of all roads, you know, led to Crowley. He was completely obsessed with himself, and he never outgrew this Edwardian need to kind of, you know, épater la bourgeoisie to shock people. And this must have come from his, you know, Christian background and all that. So, I mean, I was brought up Catholic, but none of that really meant anything to me at that point. So I outgrew it. And then the next thing I got involved with, as you mentioned, was the Gurdjieff work, which certainly was a few years later.
Let's take a brief break here, folks. We'll listen to these ads, and you can probably guess what they are because I really do need to sit down and do some new commercials. We'll be right back. Have you ever read Communion? Or have you never read Communion? It's out in a new edition. Very powerful, a subtly new cover. That reflects the fact that the visitors are now looking back at us because they truly are. You can get it from the unknowncountry.com store as a Kindle, as a beautiful, sumptuous paperback, or as an unabridged audiobook read by me. It's the first time in the whole life of Communion that it has been read in full in audio format, and believe you me, I felt that reading. I put my life, my memories into it, and I trust you can hear it in the voice. I sure felt it while I was reading. So get Communion, listen to it, read it. Communion is of central importance to all of our lives. Where is the unknown country? Is it out there in the stars? Or is it also somewhere else? Is it in us, in you? Unknown country, join us today. Go to unknowncountry.com right now and join us. Join the questions. Join the search. Join the adventure. Unknowncountry.com. There's no place like it in the world. Okay, we're back. And just before we left the air for the free those on the free feed, we were getting ready to talk about something that's a big part of my life, as most of you know, and the Gurdjieff work, and which had a major role to play in my eventual building of my relationship with the visitors. And I don't want to discuss that now. I've discussed it plenty of times. This sensing exercise thing in the Gurdjieff work is what attracted them, their attention to me in the first place. But let's talk, which my listeners mostly know about. I'm not going to discuss that. But I want to talk about your, how did you come to the work? You went to the work in Paris for a while, didn't you?
Well, I was involved in it first in New York. This would have been 1981. And
gosh,
then
we were
later,
in the, I was too. We never crossed paths though at the foundation, I don't think.
Well, that was a short time because I relocated to London. Sorry, I've moved around so much. I relocated to Los Angeles in 1982.
I see.
So I was involved for a brief time in 1981. I seem to remember the meeting places for my group was somewhere off Lexington Avenue, sort of in the lower 60s, and
63rd Street.
yeah, exactly,
I know it
yeah,
well. I
and
spent many an hour there.
yeah, and as I mentioned in the book, my the group leader was Paul Reynard, who was one of the leading instructors of the dances, and in the
Yeah, I
film, Peter
taught.
Brook
I
film. I'm sorry, go ahead.
he I taught. He taught me. He taught me movements.
Well, there you go. Well, he's, let me
Paul
say, he's
Reynard.
one of the principal instructors, and in the Peter Brook's
Yes.
film, Meetings with Remarkable Men, he's in there. So I mean, I recount that in the book, and it was remarkable meeting him. He was like, he had this fantastic presence. It was a
Peter
remarkable
Brook
thing. No,
or
I didn't mean
Paul.
Peter Brook, but Paul Reynard. Paul Reynard, I
Yeah,
meant, like
Paul
to say.
did have. I know. I never met Peter Brook personally.
Well, it was a funny thing because I moved back and forth between LA and New York a lot in the late 70s and early 80s. And at one point I was back in New York, living in the East Village on 10th Street, just off Second Ave, right near the Second Avenue Deli, if you remember
Yeah,
that.
sure.
The fellow I was subletting the place from, he himself was involved in the work, but I didn't know. Through conversations, no, what had happened, I actually attended, well, they used to, here's the thing. There was Weiser's bookshop, down in Cooper Union, in New York, the one of the great, classic occult bookshop in New York. And, there used to be these people, they were known as the people of the bookmark because they called themselves the Gurdjieff Uspensky Center. And they used to put bookmarks in all the fourth way literature. And I still have some of them, and I use them as bookmarks. But at back then, I actually I attend they were advertising for a talk, and it was at the Barbizon Hotel. So I went to this talk, and was listened to it because I'd become interested in Gurdjieff from reading about it in Colin Wilson. He wrote about it in the occult. He did a little book called The War Against Sleep that came out in 1980. That it was a short little, kind of, very, very, very simple account of Gurdjieff and Uspensky and all that. I was Uspensky, I have to say, not so much in terms of how he taught it rather than Gurdjieff taught it, but I was drawn to him just because of his earlier work too, like Tertium Organum and New Model of the Universe and Strange Life of Ivan the Sokin and things of that sort. And I just thought, okay, just like I had done with Crowley, I thought, okay, well, never the armchair philosopher. Let's go see what this is all about. And so I went to this talk, and then I mentioned it to this friend, and he said, "Well, actually, that's rubbish. But if you're interested in the real thing, call this number." So even that was kind of like, "Oh, strange. You didn't tell me about this before. Now you know." And then I called, and it was Paul Reynard, and then I wound up going to his flat, which is around the same neighborhood as where the meetings were, and it had, it was as you might expect, Oriental decor, and he was a painter. So many of his paintings are on the wall and all that. And I can't say I knew him well, but I at that meeting, it was at this point I had already, been in Blondie. I had it written like gold records, I had my own band, all this kind of stuff. And so, as they say here, I felt chuffed. As they say, I was kind of, I'm okay. And then he basically asked me the question, well, why do you want to do this? Why do you want to get involved? Which was actually a much more difficult question to answer than I thought. And I hemmed and hawed and some lamely said, well, I want to wake up or something like that. And he said, well, okay, that will take time. And do you think you can
Yes,
really,
it takes a
you
little
do you
time,
think you
all
can
right.
really commit yourself to it? And I thought, okay, yeah, let's go. So I started going to these meetings in 63rd Street. And then one of the last things I did there in New York was I was invited to a Gurdjieff celebration. And it was they celebrate on January 13th. It's his birthday,
Yes.
so I guess that's the old calendar. It was somewhere out of the city, and I was surprised to be invited because I hadn't been involved with that long. But I was invited, and went with this friend and some other people in a sedan driving out of the city quite a bit, And it was at a big estate kind of house, and we did the toast to the idiots with the vodka and all of that kind of thing. And then they tell the story in the book is that there was an announcement that for a special occasion we would be treated to a performance of Gilgamesh, and this was put on by the actor Bill Murray from Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, Bill
And
was in the work. He may still be.
I know, but for me, I didn't know that. So
Right.
I'm there, and I'm like, I'm my essence is coming out after my personality after knocking back quite a few of these vodkas, and then suddenly I see Bill Murray up there, and I have to say, whenever he said Enkidu, it's hard for me not to laugh, and it was like, who knew? But subsequently, if you know the films, I mean, Groundhog Day, people say this isn't the case, but I always thought, isn't this Ivan Ossoken? Isn't this recurrence? But then, also, he did this remake of The Razor's Edge, the old film with Tyrone Power. Back in the 40s, in the early, he did a remake of that. And there's some scene in that where he does this kind of thing where you speak ill of the dead somehow, which I remember that was kind of, I forget what it is, it's the way of something, I forget, in the tradition. So you kind of, moving them on. Don't hang around here anymore. Move on to the next kind of thing. So after seeing him at this performance, I looked back at some of the films and said, oh, I can see this. But I knew people in later when I moved to Los Angeles, I knew people in the acting world who were involved in that, because that was one of the things that drew them, this kind of role playing and psychodrama sort of thing.
Yeah, there was a lot of people in the creative communities of the world are involved with the foundation, and but it's quite private in the sense that, well, for example, Pamela Travers, the author of Mary Poppins, was deeply involved, but when you read her biography, it's not even mentioned.
Yeah.
We
Well,
have.
I actually saw her give a lecture in London about the symbolism of the bee, the beehive,
Yeah, she
and
was a one. We were very close friends. I have a whole bunch of letters from her. We spent a lot of time together when she was in New York. So I know you her well. I mean, as well as anyone who saw her
Oh
twice a
yeah,
week for
sure.
2 weeks
But
would know her.
this, I mean, seeing this lecture, this was part of what I later came to call my mini search for the miraculous. In 1983, with someone else, it was a good friend, close friend, who was in the work as well, and we went on this kind of European adventure, and part of which was going to the site of the Institute for the Harmonious Development of Man in the Prairie in Fontainebleau, in this old chateau. In the forest and all that, so that was remarkable. I mean, there was all locked up. There was nothing there, and it's kind of, but we were able to walk around and all that. And there's the plaque about Catherine Mansfield and the forest philosophers and all that sort of thing. Yeah, I mean that this. I mean, and then also a couple of years later, I was able to go in New York. Well, actually, New Jersey. This place called Franklin Farms in Mendham, which is where Uspensky sort of retreated to escape the Blitz here in the 40s, and then later came back here. So, I mean, I was involved in it for about 5 years, and I learned a lot from it, and I appreciate all the time I spent in it. But
Yeah,
I guess I'm too eclectic a kind of thinker, and I'm always interested in other things, and the other things kind of drew me away.
I have just recently quit for about the fifth time. I've been involved in it since 1969, and I'll probably get involved in it again sooner or later. But I ended up in a group that became extremely head oriented, and to me, the work is mostly attention. It's mostly about the body and the relationship between first and second body. And they didn't know anything about that. They didn't know what Gurdjieff meant by the severing of the organ Kundebuffer or anything. And to me, that's the key to everything. So anyway, but that's let's go on now. You have I want to go back to the whole idea of the substance of the esoteric. Like in my life, it's very physical. And I've had these abductions and whatnot that have happened to me. I wrote Communion about them. And I'm still very, very involved on that level. And I'm wondering if you have a level of exactly how your involvement works now. What happens and what do you do, if I may ask?
What do I do? Do I have a practice?
Yeah.
Well, I guess yes and no. I mean, actual something I do every day or whenever I remember them is write down my dreams. That's something I certainly do. And I have to say, any sort of paranormal experience I've had have been through dreams or synchronicity. So a few years back, I did a book called Dreaming Ahead of Time, which is about my experiences with precognitive dreams, which I started recording back when I was a musician back in New York, back in the late 70s, early 80s, and carried on until now. I've got a stack of journals with dream records in them. And I came to write that book over the first COVID lockdown here in 2020. Because I had given a talk about hypnagogia, the in-between state. Again, something else that I try to. When I was younger, I used to be able to hover in it longer. It's a bit more difficult now as I'm older, I find. But still, some have some of it in the morning, waking up. And but I gave a talk about that, and that state is conducive to parapsychological phenomena and mostly precognition. And so I just tacked on some accounts of precognitive dreams and some of my own at this talk. And then somebody, when I went on Twitter, somebody had been at the talk. The first thing I saw was a tweet of this person saying that I listened to this guy who said if I wrote my dreams down, I'd see the future. My God, he's right. And then she told me, she said, she I don't know how she got this on one tweet. So she must be somebody who paid for it. Got the extended version, but she said something like, "Yeah, I dreamt that I had walked out my door and picked up a hedgehog, these strange animals that they have here in Britain, and it was in the street, and I picked it up and I put it in a bush, so it would be safe." That was her dream. And then when she went on social media in the morning, the first thing she saw was a post about how to protect the hedgehogs. So she had. I would say she had a precognitive dream about seeing that post,
Yeah,
which is why
exactly.
might what you see is your own future. You don't necessarily see Criswell predicts. It's not like you predict what's going to happen. It's like you see bits and pieces of your own future. So this started happening back when I was living in New York. And funnily enough, my chronology might be off, but I had this near-death experience in the sense of I had picked up a lamp in this loft space we were in, and there was a short in it. And I was being electrocuted, and there was no one around me in the loft. I was in this room by myself, and I couldn't speak. I was paralyzed, and I didn't see any tunnel, but I saw a black cloud back here coming closer and closer over me. And I thought, my God, once that gets kind of up front, I'm fried. I'm done for. And luckily enough, the guitarist Chris Stein just out of nowhere, because he could not have heard me saying anything, walked out of the back room, saw me, and just pulled the plug. But it was sort of after that like when we went on our first tour, sorry, I'm giving all this backstory to this, but when we went on our first the first big Blondie North American tour, we were the support act for Iggy Pop. And my girlfriend and I, Lisa, at the time, whenever I wanted to call her, she wanted to call me. And this was back in the day where you had to be someplace to make a phone call and be
Right.
someplace to get the phone call. None of what we have these days. Each of us would have been ready to call the other. So I would have been about to pick up the phone to call her when it rings and she's calling me, or vice versa. Or and then we would talk about dreams and there was some shared stuff. I can't remember exactly what the content was, but that was the thing. And that became the inspiration for the song, I'm Always Touched by Your Presence, Dear, which was a big hit in the UK and in Europe. So I mean that I continue to do a practice of that these days. But I try to apply, in everyday life, I guess. So, I mean, I've been actually writing a book about this now. The working title is That We Forget That We Exist, which is not bad off that we don't, not far off from we don't remember, we fail to remember ourselves. But,
Yeah.
if you can kind of like today, Thursday, I clean my flat on Thursdays. So I take that as an opportunity to try to use that as a kind of self-remembering meditation. So however reluctant I am to go and start dusting and vacuuming, I overcome the reluctance, and then I put myself into what I'm doing. And then it actually becomes kind of pleasurable because I'm doing it. I'm doing it.
I know the feeling, and they teach that at the work too.
So yeah, well, that's it. So you are doing it rather, I mean, the way I tend to see it is more just because it's he's been a huge influence on me, but Colin Wilson's work, and he talks about the robot, which is this labor-saving evolutionary device that we developed over time to take care of all sort of the hard, the grunt work. So whenever you learn to type, ride a bicycle, speak a foreign language, whatever it is, it's incredibly difficult as you first start doing it. And you have to be there. You have to pay attention. You have to see where you're putting your finger. And then at some point, well, Gurdjieff would say, moving center takes over or whatever, and intellectual center can be thinking about something else. What do I want to type? Where do I want to go with the bike? What do we want to say in French? So it's a higher order thing. But this robot is so good. It's an over-efficient valet who wants to take care of everything. And in slowly, involuntarily, we tend to give over everything to the robot until we're mechanical, like Gurdjieff says. And then we start to ask, as T.S. Eliot said, where is the life we have lost in living? Why is everything stale, flat, and unprofitable? Well, it's because you aren't doing it. The robot's doing it. So Wilson came up with this. For him, he discovered this empirically, that one thing that can throw the robot off is inconvenience. And as we know, Gurdjieff was a master of creating inconvenience. He was a master of creating artificial chaos. And in this book about Maurice Nicole, and I had access to these diaries that Nicole has, and that they're up in the University of Edinburgh, and his accounts of being there, in the priory. It's all about nobody knows what's going on. Is there really an institute here? It's sort of like, where is the institute? Everything is kind of like shifting and sliding and around, and Gurdjieff saying something different to everybody, and everyone's on their toes constantly. So he was a master of creating kind of situation where your robot doesn't have any time to settle in, and you are there. And it must have been a remarkable time for people, and they did remarkable things like build that study house and things like that. But it's nothing on that same level, but I try to apply that kind of awareness to kind of everyday things, and I'm not that successful at it, but occasionally I am.
Well, I think being successful at it is always an illusion in a sense, in that if it's not surprising, it's not entirely real. And
That's no, absolutely. That's the essence of this book I'm working on now. That you nailed it. That's actually it. That's absolutely it.
That's the direction of awakening, of true awakening. I want to get back to rock and roll, and there are quite a number of people who went into rock and roll and then moved into esoteric directions of esoteric studies, magic, and so forth and so on. Some of them very, very underground about it. Chuck E. Weiss, do you know his work at all? He
Know
used
the
to
name, but not at all. No, I don't know his work.
perform at the Viper Club here in on Sunset, and
All right. Well, I know the Viper Room. Yeah, I've been there. Yeah,
Viper Room. Yeah, that's right. And
yeah, yeah.
I never could. I had a couple of contacts with him. I never could tell whether he was sort of shining me on because he knew I was in, fairly advanced in the occult, or exactly what was going on. But in any case, that's neither here nor there. What I'm interested in is where the music, did the music take you here, do you think, or
Oh,
not?
no, it was the books. No, it was the books. It was the
It
books.
was the books.
It was the books. It was the books. I mean, I said, once I read Wilson's The Occult, it was the page turner. I couldn't put it down. This book is unputdownable. And I was just completely, I mean, I said, read Hesse, and I had this high school teacher who was giving me Sartre to read, and I had discovered Walter Kaufmann's translations of Nietzsche. And I was reading those and all this kind of stuff, not understanding all of it. I mean, I wasn't a Wunderkind, but I was reading it. I wanted to get, so I had a kind of background in that kind of, pop existentialism, Zen, D.T. Suzuki, Hesse. And then Wilson's book kind of had all that, plus all these other people I'd never heard about, like Crowley, like Madame Blavatsky, like Gurdjieff, like Uspensky, like Rasputin, like Yeats and the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, and so on and so on, and also just taking it back into history. I mean, if you haven't read it, it's actually actually it still stands up, I think, as one of these good kind of this is just a good read book. And he in that book itself, he talks about something he called Faculty X, which he just was he didn't have a name, but it was something he called our ability to grasp the reality of other times and places, which is not nostalgia. But his classic example is if in the beginning of Proust's novel, Recherche au temps perdu, where the character tastes the cake dipped in a little, tisane, a little herb tea, and
Right.
suddenly he has this fantastic memory and he doesn't know what it is, and oh, he's brought back to his childhood holidays. And it's not as if he factually knew that he went to Cambrai and had the holidays there, but suddenly it's not the factual memory, it's this 3D HD. Whatever you want to call current attempts, artificial attempts to create reality that, is never quite as real as when it really is real. So, but it's a suddenly, reality is not what's, reality exceeds what's immediately present to us. We're hypnotized by what's right in front of our face, but reality is beyond that. But it's not the senses that grasp that reality, it's some other faculty. Imagination isn't quite the right word because, that can slip into fantasy and all that. But I had those experiences. I knew what he was talking about, and I thought, okay, I know what he's talking about here. So that kind of led me to go read all of the books he wrote before, and then I made this pilgrimage to his home in Cornwall in 1983, after going to the Prairie in Fontainebleau and places like Glastonbury and Avebury and Stonehenge. I was totally into ley lines and megaliths at the time, and I had my Ordnance Survey map with me. And trying to track, ley lines and where the next standing stone was. But I made this pilgrimage
Well,
down to Cornwall to meet Colin Wilson.
and you met him.
Oh yeah, met him. And then since then we
I'd
carried
love to have
on.
met him. Can tell us a little bit about Colin Wilson?
Well, Colin Wilson, he came to fame at the age of 24 in 1956 with his first book came out. It'll be 70 years next year, called The Outsider. And this was a study in extreme mental states of these characters that had a deep hunger and appetite and need for meaning and purpose in the world that can no longer provide this, the secular world, geared towards materialism and comfort and things of that sort. And people like Hesse and Nietzsche and Sartre and Hemingway and Camus and all these others. And he was actually one of the first ones to write about Gurdjieff, not involved. In the work. So this would have come out in 56. The books that had come out after that, it would, Beelzebub's Tales, published Miraculous, Kenneth Walker's books. But Wilson was one of the first ones to write about it outside of, the people who were involved in it. And it was strange overnight bestseller in England, of all places, which is a country not necessarily that interested in sort of existential ideas and about meaning and purpose and all this sort of stuff. And then there was a backlash against him, and because he wasn't interested in politics and he was interested in sort of religious questions and existential questions and meaning and that sort of thing, and he just kept writing and he developed this whole it's not a system but a body of work that he called he was trying to develop a new existentialism, positive existentialism. I mean, I wound up writing a book about him called Beyond the Robot that. Beyond the Robot, The Life of Work and Colin Wilson. So it's out of print, but it's coming back into print soon. And he had a second sort of career when he was asked in the late 60s to write a book about the occult, because
Right.
there had been this revival of interest in the occult that started with this book, The Mourning of the Magicians in 1960 in France, of all places.
An
Louis
incredible book
Pyle,
in itself.
I'm sorry?
The Mourning of the Magicians is an incredible book in itself.
Oh yeah. I mean,
Absolutely.
and it's the book that you never have thought to have been a bestseller where and when it was, because it appeared in 1960 in the the Paris of Sartre and Marxism, and everything's black and white and berets and jetons and all that. And suddenly it's like, as I said in my book, it's like a UFO had landed in front of the Café du Mego. And suddenly it's a book about UFOs, it's about alchemy, it's a book about Gurdjieff, it's about Crowley, Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, all this kind of stuff that hadn't yet been packaged in a way and presented to the public. Where we had Velikovsky's book, Worlds in Collision, and T.C. Lombroom's books about, Tibet, but they had a readership. But this was like a big, big book. And as you know, it was a bestseller. And it kickstarted this whole interest in the 1960s about the occult. By the mid-decade, 1967, the most famous people in the world were into it, the Beatles, because they had Crowley on the cover of Sgt. Pepper's with Jung, Aldous Huxley,
Right.
and other figures. So this became sort of the center of, like, all this was happening. And Wilson was asked to write a book about this. And his first, thought was like, well, I've always had an interest in spiritualism and all this kind of stuff. And he wrote a book about Rasputin. Crowley was a character in one of his early novels, but he always kind of tongue in cheek. He was an existentialist, and he said, well, this is probably mostly a lot of, self-deception. But as he did the research for the occult, he became convinced. And he just became convinced there's enough statistical evidence for this stuff to say it's not about rubbish, it's not, superstition, it's real. And then he started to apply existential phenomenological kind of analytical discipline that he had to his earlier books to the occult. And that's what I picked up on when I read this book, because it wasn't just a book about spells and ghosts. It was him trying to understand, what does this mean about human consciousness? If these things are possible, what does this mean about consciousness? So that's what I go, yeah, what does that mean? And I wanted to experience these other states that he was talking about.
Those of us on you on the free side, we're going to be saying goodbye now, and we'll stay with Colin because I'm very interested in getting a little deeper into something we touched on earlier, which is your interest in magic and whether or not practical magic, because I've had some experiences with this too, and I know it is real. But it's also very elusive. And I have a feeling that my listeners and viewers on YouTube will be interested in what you have to say about whether or not it works and how. So stay with us, subscribers. And those of you on the free side, thank you very much for joining us on Dreamland, as always.
Thank you for listening. Dreamland is brought to you by Unknown Country and its family of subscribers. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our site coordinator is Amy Safrankova. The founder of UnknownCountry.com is Ann Strieber. I'm Whitley Strieber, your host for Dreamland.